I've talked to teachers at many schools who say that they feel that parents are worried that their kids are going to lag behind, and especially if they go to a school where they're studying Latin, that their technical skills are going to be deficient, and then they'll end up on Skid Row eventually because they can't work technically. A lot of serious people in computer work realize that teaching three-year-olds, or, well, third graders, rather, not three, it may start that early, teaching third graders to how to do programming, you remember 20, 30 years ago, everything was, let's teach all the kids BASIC, because it's really important for them to know BASIC. When they grow up, they'll have to be doing computer programming, right? So how many of you studied BASIC in grade school, and how useful is that for you right now? Yeah, I thought so. So, in fact, because the technology's changed so much, a lot of attention that we give to specific craft is really ends up being useless, and which is not to say that the technologies should be abandoned. But what I want to look at this morning is how media technologies shape our culture at a deeper level, and that the challenge for educators is to recognize those deeper effects as you both implement and teach about technology, because I'm a firm believer that as kids, especially in the older grades, they need to be technologically discerning. It's more important that they understand what technology does than how it works. And unfortunately, a lot of media education and technology education is geared toward mastering techniques and not toward encouraging reflection, toward wisdom about what the things are actually doing in our lives. And that's an important goal, I think, that schools ought to have. Communications media, like all technologies, don't simply accomplish a specific task. Because they give the experience of our lives a particular shape, they change the shape of our engagement with the world and our relationship with others. Because they reconfigure how we make our way through life, they also alter our understanding of ourselves. An example, cell phones and cell phone etiquette. How many times now do you see someone talking on a phone, well, especially if they got one of those little Bluetooth things, and they look like they're muttering to themselves, and of course we hope they're not. but cell phones now have changed the character, sometimes subtly, sometimes dramatically, of the experience of physical presence among people. It used to be that if you were physically present, especially in a relatively small enclosed space, like an elevator, you would acknowledge the presence of the other by a greeting or some other eye contact, something. And usually the only people who avoided eye contact were crazy people or people who were afraid that there were crazy people nearby. Which is what happens, you walk down a city street and you kind of avoid eye contact. Cell phones have now changed very often our experience of physical space with others and changed the nature of how we relate to those around us, so that cell phones create something like that zone of secrecy that Maxwell Smart used to have or tried to have. It's almost as if we think that we have this shield around us sets us off from the people around us and gives us the right to ignore people around us, which may be what we wanted to do anyway. But patterns of civility and manners have encouraged us not to behave that way. The technology arrives. We get these new gadgets, and they come with this 200-page guide on how to use it and program it. But there's nothing in the booklet about manners. There's nothing in the booklet about etiquette, about the shape of interpersonal relationships. There's a lot about programming it, but nothing about how it programs you. And that's true of lots and lots of technologies that rearrange the shape of our everyday experience, the patterns of relationships, in such a way that eventually the nature of the relationship changes. And it's not just the newfangled technologies that have arisen since I became middle-aged that do this, lest you think, actually, I'm not a Luddite, I'm a recovering technophiliac. I love gadgets way too much, and so a lot of my thinking and reading about technologies has been an effort at therapy, at trying to keep them in a proper place in my life. But it, as I say, it's not just the newer digital technologies. I had an interesting conversation years ago with Gilbert Mailander, the Lutheran ethicist, whose father was a Lutheran pastor. And he told me a story. He said it was common in Lutheran churches for the parishioners to meet with... They didn't have, in his church at least, they didn't have the sacrament, communion every Sunday. So they would have it periodically, and it was still expected, even though they didn't practice confession, it was still expected that individuals would just have a talk with the pastor, a kind of an informal talk with the pastor before going to the table. It was a way that of kind of a preventative pastoral care. And Gil told me the story when he was about 12 years old. He remembers this time he was at home one afternoon and the phone rang. He was the only one there. He picked it up, and it was somebody from the church. He said, "Gilbert, how are you? Is your dad there?" "No." "Oh, will you tell him I'll be at church on Sunday?" Now, Gil realized that this phone message that he was taking was a surrogate for an actual face-to-face encounter between his father, the pastor, and the parishioner. And he said he remembered having a sense that some threshold had been crossed, that suddenly the pastoral care that his father was offering had diminished significantly because now, instead of the face-to-face conversation, he had a phone message. That's an example of, you know, there are lots of ways our lives have already been rearranged by the technologies that were already there before we, you know, before we were even born, that we're not aware of. And I think growing in wisdom about the use of technology is growing in recognition that there are many ways in which our lives are deformed because of those technologies. Almost all technologies are designed to increase convenience, to give us more power over things than we had. And that usually means they increase our independence. And increasing our independence has the unanticipated consequence, usually, of encouraging in us the deep assumption that our lives are really fulfilled or more fulfilled in direct proportion to our freedom from others. So if we don't have to deal with the sales clerk or the travel agent and can book our flight online, we're freer. If we don't have to deal with the bank teller to get the withdrawal and we get it from the ATM machine, we're freer. We're more fulfilled as people. I think there's a sense in which that notion of autonomy, which is one of the big stories of modernity, the increase in the sense of autonomy of individuals. The technologies, again, encourage us to have this deep assumption that we really are more fulfilled and more complete as human beings, truly free when we're free from the necessity of others. Every now and then, the power goes off and we have to rely on our neighbors for things that we normally don't have to. And then we kind of have some warm feelings of community possibly accompanying that. But then we go back to life in that kind of autonomous zone. I just mentioned this because I think that it's helpful to realize that technologies do that in our lives and encourage us to have that sense of autonomy, which is not really true. We really do rely on others. We rely on the guys who keep the power coming. We rely on the people who invented the machines we use and who maintain them and who sold them to us. We rely on the UPS driver who delivers all the things we just ordered online. We depend on others, but they become invisible and intangible. So we have this illusion of independence. And And that encourages this notion that that's really fulfillment. Theologically, since we're created in the image of a triune God, we're created for relationship, and we're created to find our fulfillment in relationship with others, not apart from others. Technologies also have another kind of disengaging effect. They increase our power to do the things we want, and they often detach us from the context in which our lives are actually lived. Let me give a couple of examples. Travel technologies. I get on a plane, I go up in the air, I come down, and I'm somewhere else. And I have no idea where I am. I don't have to have any sense of geography. I don't have to have any sense of the place where I am. I get into a shuttle, I go to a hotel, I'm indoors. I don't know it's 100 degrees outside. I could be in Milwaukee. Because the technologies that enable me to get here, which I actually appreciate air conditioning, I'm thankful for it. However, it does give me a sense of detachment. I've been in so many hotels and hotel ballrooms and motels that they start to run together, and I don't have any sense of where I am. So that the technologies that enable this gathering, which is a wonderful thing to be able to do that, they also detach us in a certain sense from place, which I think is a significant detachment. More recently, GPS technologies, which enable us to find our way somewhere, but to find our way as if by rote. You follow the directions, or you use MapQuest or Google Maps, and you just get a list of all the turns you're supposed to take and how many tenths of a mile it is to the next intersection. Rather than studying a map that you have to kind of deal with in your hands, rather than studying a map and getting a sense of the lay of the land and how, oh, that road runs right along the river, and there are 6 bridges that cross the river, and they're all clustered at the southern side of the city, and then there are these hills that run along here, and there are 2 large roads, and they intersect twice, not once, but twice, once north of town and once south of town. Rather than developing some understanding of the shape of a place, which could in fact help us understand something of the history and something of how the geography shaped the culture, which actually gives us a greater sense of where we are, rather than getting engaged with the reality of the place, we just follow directions to take the turns that we're told to, whether they're printed up on the sheet or whether the voice is telling us, turn left, okay? Now again, it's not a bad thing, but I just want to call attention to what we lose when we gain something. There's a price, okay? And it's not just the $300 for the GPS unit that's the price. The price is that we no longer look at maps. I have no idea what side of Austin I'm on right now. Of course, I didn't actually drive here. Somebody picked me up. This has happened to me a lot of times now that I rely on MapQuest, which I do appreciate, but then I realize if I take a wrong turn, getting my way back and finding my way back becomes rather precarious. Now, unless I have the GPS, right? That's why we have those. Calculators. George Grant mentioned yesterday something to this effect. Calculators allow people to perform arithmetic and mathematical tasks without any kind of understanding of numeric or mathematical relations. You don't have a sense of the inner workings of math, of the context of math. Cash registers that don't even have numbers, now they have an icon for the Big Mac. So people don't even have to... And then the change... I've seen a lot of poor cashiers try to count out change, and they can't figure out how to make change because they don't have any understanding of what's going on arithmetically. So the technology enables power, but it enables power by detaching us from the reality of the thing that we're working with. And that's an important thing to keep in mind. Information technologies particularly deliver information without context. They deliver data without context. Every time I read something about this, I'm reminded of a point that Richard Weaver made in his book, Ideas Have Consequences, in which he observes that modern man has been told there is no such thing as truth, so he'll settle for facts. It's a really bad thing to settle for facts. All of life becomes then a big game of trivial pursuits where you're just acquiring lots of isolated facts that may be true, but there's no truth behind these individual facts. Now, hyperlinks, to use a particular information technology, hyperlinks have the possibility of providing some sort of context for knowledge, but because they're often used very thoughtlessly, and because they're often, both by the programmer and by the person using them, they give the impression that knowledge is just a bunch of randomly related facts, not something that has a kind of coherence to it. And without ordered knowledge, I would suggest wisdom becomes impossible, because wisdom requires a sense of the whole of things. Moral philosopher and theologian Oliver O'Donovan has commented on this matter of knowledge in context in his description or his explanation of why truth has authority in our lives. And he argues in his book Resurrection and Moral Order that the authority of truth belongs to the order of things as a totality. Reflection in obedience to truth is reflection about the relations of things. Such reflection takes on the specific character of moral reflection when it is directed to discerning the good of human action, which conforms to the truth of the created order. In other words, our obedience to God takes place within a context in which we have to weigh many considerations very often. And wisdom is the acquisition of enough of a sense of that context so that we begin to, as it were, almost intuitively sense the relationship between various moral obligations and moral opportunities. The authority of truth, he says, can be called moral authority when this context of moral reflection is in view. There is given in creation an order within which our actions attain their intelligibility. Our task as moral agents is to participate in this order, understanding it and conforming to it in what we think and in what we do. But again, if we perceive knowledge and hence reality as just a lot of unattached, unrelated, random factoids, which is increasingly the case. Watch news television, and not only are people giving you stories out of context, not explaining why something happened or what it means, but then you get the crawl at the bottom that's giving you little factoids, and something comes along the side, and you know some vision pops up in the middle somewhere, and all these little snippets of information that quickly become disposable, and the medium conveys a sense of chaos. It's a chaos that's interesting, but it's still chaotic. If our perception of reality is fragmented or disoriented, then truth and wisdom are threatened, and obedience becomes possible only as a blind and irrational act of following orders. But that's not a biblical picture of obedience. Obedience makes sense because it fits the order of reality as God has made it. So the fragmenting character of knowledge as mediated by information media poses serious problems in, again, our intuitive sense of the way the world is and the way creation is. The media can still be very useful tools, but only if people using them have first acquired a sense of that context and comprehensiveness of God's truth and the order of reality. I don't think you would acquire that sense of the order of reality just through those media, though. I think that has to be acquired else in another way. Now, I have on the outline, by the way, I want to apologize if my lecture doesn't seem to be following the outline. I don't do outlines normally, but these people here are so insistent. So I gave them the outlines months ago before I actually figured out what I wanted to say. And this afternoon it's going to be even worse, but I tried to get all of these themes. I mean, I sat down one day, I figured, well, what kinds of things would I like to talk about? And this is a problem of knowledge out of context. I came up with factoids without a story, okay? Now, then when I got around to trying to construct the story, I realized that it was hard to drive past all of those points of interest. But I will talk about senses and sensibilities. That is, our perception of things and through our senses, and the kinds of sensory input, if I can use a relatively ugly phrase, that information technologies provide us, and the kinds of sensibilities those sensations, those sensory perceptions create. First, media, as we experience them, not just information media, but all mass media, don't just deliver information, they also form desires. This is why advertising proliferates in all of our media. It need not, but it does. If you want to get the New York Times for free, you have to tolerate all the advertising banners and those little dancing figures that show up to tell you how mortgage rates have dropped again. And so the media, as we know it, them, rather, it's a plural noun, media as we know them actually come embedded in a commercial setting, and the function they play is to form desires. If we had more time, I'd suggest that visual media has a tendency, unlike verbal media, already to kind of move towards the shaping of desire. But we don't have time to go into that. First of all, desire for things. We see things and we want them. But also desire for experiences, desire for love, desire for acceptance, desire for pleasure or security or power or happiness, or even the desire for desire itself. Sometimes people feel kind of lethargic and they go shopping, not because they want something, but because they want to want something. And so you go shopping to develop the desire for desire. And advertisers are brilliant at stoking this kind of perpetual desire for desire. Okay, that's just a reality. We have to recognize that's there. So mass media, one of the desires that we have acquired is a desire for novelty and the sensation of speed. We want new things, and we want things to happen in relatively quick succession, or we get bored. Try living without the internet for a week, or without your cell phone, or without, you know, go on a media fast. I always recommend, this is a great way to develop attention to the way your desires are shaped and your affections have been shaped, is just do without the stuff you're used to for a while. But we you know, this happens to, again, I say this in recovery. My name is Ken, and I'm a mediaholic. You know, I've just looked at that blog 5 minutes ago, and I'm clicking on the link again because maybe there's something interesting that now that. So that desire, and maybe all of you don't struggle with this, but I don't think I'm alone in this. Actually, there's a lot of research to suggest that I'm not. Mass media increase exponentially our exposure to sensations and to information, and so they both satisfy and evoke our thirst for novelty. One of the books on my list is Todd Gitlin's book, Media Unlimited, and Todd Gitlin in that book argues that our experience with mass media encourages us to expect new and intensely exciting emotions that can quickly be forgotten and disposed of. In fact, that's his most wonderful insight in that book is he says media have encouraged us to have created in us a new way of having emotions, not new emotions, but a new way of relating to our emotions. We want intense emotions in a hurry, but we want intense emotions that we can dispose of in a hurry. And so you look at how 30-second commercials are created and the way they build and the way they grab us, and then they're gone, and you're in another commercial. And so we have, we become used to having this roller coaster kind of experience, and we expect it. And then you try to sit down and read a book, and it doesn't work that way. Or you try to pray, and it doesn't work that way. I'm convinced that those of us who are not entirely sanguine about the shape of contemporary worship, I think contemporary worship has taken the form of the kinds of expectations people have of this intense and yet disposable emotional experience. Gitlin says, to grow up in this culture is to grow into an expectation that images and sounds will be there for us on command, and that the stories they compose will be succeeded by still other stories, all bidding for our attention, all striving to make sense, all, in some sense, ours. Here he alludes to the idea that we're really sovereign consumers of things. We orchestrate a personal and unique cultural experience tailored to our own desires when we click on all those links independently, or when we zap the channels with the remote. I'm told, by the way, that men do this more frequently than women with the remote. Is this your experience, ladies, that the men? And the reason for this is that women are willing to watch a bad program and try to nurture it into being better. Is that, I don't know if that's true. You can discuss that later. There are a lot of things at work with this zapping or clicking culture. We have the idea of control. We see what we want to see, listen to what we want to listen to. We have the idea of change. We can change things rapidly. We can move on to other things. We get to choose things, and we anticipate choosing new things all the time. So, again, this creates a kind of desire, a kind of expectation in our lives. There's a sense in which I think many people living in this kind of ecosystem want pleasures that are both intense and fleeting. And we want them to not only to be fleeting, but we want them to be fast, fleet. Gitlin says, the promise of speed is nowhere more fully realized than in the media and the culture of switching that surrounds them. It's not surprising that experts in marketing who advise churches agree if you want to attract people, you have to feature music that is new and fast also. Familiar and contemplative music won't strike a responsive chord in people who prefer the fleet and the fleeting. And Gitlin talks about living in a torrent of images and sounds. That's the subtitle to the book. And people who've adjusted to living in a torrent and who think a torrent is normal find it hard to come in out of the wind and the rain. If you're used to being overwhelmed, then experiences that are slow and thoughtful seem underwhelming. Again, this is a problem. This is, I think, one of the reasons why reading above in the lives of people above, say, 15 years old has plummeted. The habit of reading has dropped. The National Endowment for the Arts reported recently, in the last 20 years, the number of people who read a book in a given year has dropped, like, in some age groups, 20%. It's huge. And I'm convinced part of it is because reading requires an attentiveness and a patience that the experience of communications media not only doesn't require, but actually works in our brain chemistry to make it more difficult for us. And here, the book I mentioned on the reading list by Richard de Grandpré called Ritalin Nation, which cites a lot of research that's been done on how our brain chemistry is actually affected by this kind of sensory input. So I need to move on. I have more material to talk here about speed, but I think I want to move on so we can get through to talking about the book list. I have representations and realities, and there I'm talking about how communications media present things to us that are always processed and altered in some way, and that sometimes we come to prefer the alteration to the reality. Richard de Grandpré, who I just mentioned, wrote an article back in 2001 in a rather subversive magazine called Adbusters, in which he talked about how we come to prefer virtual reality to reality. And he cited some experiments done back in the 30s by a perceptual psychologist named James Gibson, in which people were given glasses that distorted their vision, which made straight lines seem curved, but their brain eventually compensated for that, for this fact. And eventually the curved lines seemed to be straight. The brain actually started to work to straighten them out. But and when the glasses were removed, then straight lines were perceived to be curving. Now there's an interesting parable there. And he relates this to what he calls the beauty myth, and the problem that particularly he relates this to the problem of eating disorders among young women. He said, young women have millions of exemplars from which to judge the sizes and shapes of the female body, yet this vast pool of reality is somehow overridden by a narrow band of hyper-reality. This is a perfect match with the finding of Gibson's classic study. Many young women presented with their own image fail to see what appears on their retinas. Instead, as researchers have now documented, they often perceive a distorted, fatter version of themselves. Again, their sense of reality derives from cumulative experience with the goal of adapting to whatever reality appears to be most pressing or valuable. Unfortunately for many women, this valued reality happens to make them sick. The mind isn't some kind of computer that remains unchanged as cultural software runs through its cerebral circuits. Conscious reality changes as the software of everyday life changes and remains changed thereafter. Whether it's watching television, surfing the web, viewing the latest special effects movie, chronic exposure to simulated ideas, moods, and images condition your sensibilities for how the real world should look, how fast it should go, how you should feel when living in it. When 1,000 points of light shine upon you in a commercial war for your thoughts, your feelings, and your desires, your mind adapts, accepts, and then, to feel simulated, needs more. Kids 25 years ago forfeited quarters to a video game called Pong. Pong is to Sony PlayStation 2, and this was written already 7 years ago. Pong is to Sony PlayStation 2 what a firecracker is to the atomic bomb. As you adapt to the latest digital experiences straying farther and farther from your home world of the here and now, the home world becomes less satisfying each time you return to it. The virtual becomes the only reality that counts. This is a huge problem for kids who spend a lot of time with video games, particularly. But it's not just video games. You could have the same effect through other media. You could even have the same effect through books. And yet, because of the fact that video games have such a command on our senses, they really do create a sense of reality that is so kind of compelling. But again, it's a sense of reality or a representation, not reality itself. Now, I want to jump on to the last big section and talk about some of your, very briefly, some of the kinds of challenges and how I think you might address these. And when I talk about distinguishing means from ends, Jacques Ellul, I can't remember, I know I said this recently, and I may have said this in yesterday's lecture, I can't remember. Jacques Ellul, in his book, The Technological Society, points out that one of the effects of living with a lot of technologies is that we become preoccupied with means, with techniques, and we lose sight of our reflection on ends, our goals, what we want to do with it to things. And this happens in a lot of settings. When I read that, I suddenly felt a great sense of awareness of why so many church committee meetings had been frustrating for me. And it was because I remembered a lot of times we were sitting around discussing a task, But we never really address what are we really trying to accomplish. We spent time developing, you know, here's how we're going to do it. I one time in particular, I was on a committee to look for a new youth pastor. And we never really talked about what youth ministry ought to accomplish, what role it had in the ministry of the rest of the church. But we talked about, well, he's got to be able to play the guitar, and he's got, you know. You know, there are a list of means without really getting to the ends. Now, sometimes it's assumed we all agree on the ends, but sometimes, or it's assumed we can't possibly agree on the ends, so we'll just forget that and we'll just talk about, we'll try to come up with techniques that all of us can agree on, even if we don't know what we're aiming at. That's a big, big mistake in most of life. I think there's a temptation, and I alluded to when I started, there's a temptation to assume that teaching kids to become adept at using informational media will automatically educate them. You wouldn't think that about, say, chainsaws. Give the kid a chainsaw and he'll know how to cut down a tree safely. You wouldn't think that. Or a lot of, I don't know, medical technology. Give him an MRI, he'll figure out what he can, you know, how to be healthy. But I think, again, we're partly a victim of the marketing departments of these high-tech firms that suggest that if you just have the device will fulfill what you want it to. Where do you want to go today? Okay. But that's not true for reasons I've tried to allude to, that the devices carry with them, in a sense, their own agenda, their own prejudices, which we can work against if we're alert to how the devices, what the devices are doing. But we really have to know what are our goals in education, not just what kind of content do we want to convey, but what kinds of sensibilities, what kinds of affections, what kinds of orientations of the heart and soul need to be in place for education to happen best. A great analogy to this is the argument that Paul uses in the letter to Titus, in which Titus is a young pastor confronting all sorts of heretics in the church. And rather than Paul saying, just give them more theology, he has this weird comment where he quotes a Cretan philosopher, says all Cretans are, that Crete is where Titus was, all Cretans are evil beasts, lazy gluttons, and liars, evil beasts and lazy gluttons. This testimony is true, he says. What's that about? What, you know, this little politically incorrect cheap shot here. But then if you go on and read the whole letter, you realize that he tells Titus, teach those things which are in accordance with sound doctrine. Teach them to be self-controlled. Teach them to be reverent. In other words, inculcate in them a set of attitudes, a set of orientations, which will make them susceptible to hearing the truth, which will give them the kinds of habits of the heart, if you will, that will enable them to be patient enough to hear the truth and to be deliberate enough in trying to stick with the truth and be consistent with it. It's a wonderful analogy for educators that we're always working with orientation. We're always working with those preoccupations and realizing how media technology is likely to skew the orientations in one way or another is very, very, very helpful. So you know what you're working against. I would recommend on this list Steve Talbot's recent book, Devices of the Soul, Battling for Ourselves in an Age of Machines, in which he has several essays particularly about educators and about defining goals as educators in light of the kinds of clamoring claims that technologies make on us. Establishing a sense of knowledge in context. I've already talked about this a little bit, and I think practically your students need to learn how to recognize what are reliable sources of information. They need to learn that facts have to be understood in some kind of context. And so I would suggest that you possibly assign work that doesn't require research on the internet. Say, okay, here's a research for older kids, obviously. Here's a research project. Use books. Use only books. The cover story of the Atlantic Monthly this month, How Google Makes Us Stupid, I encourage you to read, because it talks, again, on this idea of facts out of context. And it's a very perceptive essay. Promote monotasking. I don't think I'd ever heard the word monotasking. I actually thought of it a few months ago, and I realized that one of my problems was multitasking, and, well, the alternative is monotasking. I know Kierkegaard says somewhere, purity of heart is to will one thing, and I guess just doing one thing at a time would relate to that in some way. So I thought of the word, and like 2 days later, I saw an article in Atlantic, in the November 2007 issue, called The Autumn of the Multitaskers, which talked both anecdotally and scientifically on research that how, yes, multitasking is doing something bad to your brain. So it doesn't just promote. Now, a lot of us like to multitask because it makes us feel efficient, like good stewards of our time. If we do three things at once, then God will like us more because we've gotten more done. But actually, first of all, there's a question of whether we are actually are getting more done or whether we're really attending to the particular task, to any one of the tasks that we're doing when we're doing three things at once. But actually, it does also affect your brain chemistry, it turns out. That so there's actually some interesting backlash that's happening both culturally and scientifically, questioning whether this really is a good way to live. Whether, I said yesterday, and it's a theme I rehearse over and over, that good cultural lives, patterns of good cultural life, are always take into account the kinds of creatures we are. And the kinds of creatures we are isn't just moral and rational and spiritual, but it's also physical. And so the relationship between our brain and our mind is something that we have to take seriously. It turns out that life is better lived in certain patterns of behavior, which may not be the patterns of behavior which are encouraged by our technologies, which is why deliberateness is always necessary. Also, another citation that's not on your list that deals with multitasking in the current issue of The New Atlantis, which is a journal that deals with technology and culture, published by the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington. Christine Rosen, whose name is on your bibliography, has an essay in which she looks at several other articles on this problem of multitasking. I encourage you to read that. And then finally, finding the off button. I mentioned media fasts. I mentioned encouraging research that doesn't use the internet. I'd also suggest that tell the kids to get outside. I read some research recently that's indicated how many schools had eliminated recess because they were afraid of lawsuits from kids getting hurt. That was one reason. And in fact, I read one educational psychologist who said she saw increasingly a pattern that schools were eliminating recess, but then they were having to have seminars for grade school kids on conflict resolution. She said, just, why don't they just go out to the playground? They would learn something about conflict resolution. So there's kind of a natural way in which some of that wisdom could be acquired, but we've eliminated that. Let's talk about this reading list real quickly. Oh, and before, one other thing I didn't put on here. There was a recent Frontline documentary, which I think you can watch for free on their website at pbs.org and kind of navigate your way through to Frontline, called Growing Up Online. It's a documentary, hour-long documentary about a high school in New Jersey where they look at the lives of 8 or 10 high school kids and how living with the internet has changed their relationships, changed their... particularly their understanding of who they are, their own sense of identity. And it's a wonderful, very insightful documentary. There's not a kind of a ominous voiceover telling us all the bad things. The kids just explain their lives, and it's pretty obvious many of the disorders that have occurred. Like I said, you can watch it. You can order it on DVD, which would be a good thing to watch with parents, because I think a key issue here is after the kids go home, what kinds of technologies and media engagement do they have for the rest of the day? That would be a really scary one for a lot of parents to see. So encourage them. I gathered together what I thought might be some of the most helpful things. Some of these I've already alluded to. There's a group called the Alliance. Unfortunately, let me say one thing. A lot of these people, you're not going to like politically and theologically, okay? I don't. I think people who are, well, my theory is, and I said this yesterday during the panel discussion, that Christians often don't focus as much attention on the actual phenomena of cultural issues because we're in too much of a hurry to get to some spiritual insight, or because we think, well, it's all going to burn up anyway, so what does it matter? We'll just wait for the rapture. So, or we just say, well, of course the world is disordered, but we have hope in Christ, and so we don't pay attention. For people, for secularists for whom this world is all there is, they sometimes tend to be keenly aware of disorders. They don't know how to fix it necessarily. They don't have the resources necessarily to fix it, but often there's a great keen awareness of that. The other thing is for social conservatives, that is for people who don't have an animus against capitalism as such, we sometimes tend to be a little bit more pliant in the face of the claims of advertisers and commercial culture. Yet I would argue that commercial culture, I'm not anti-capitalist, but commercial culture is much more culturally destructive than left-wing politics. Things advertisers do and things that, I'll leave it at that. Things advertisers do has been much more disordering culturally than things that Greenpeace or ACT UP or groups like that have done. And we can argue that claim later. I say that because you might read some of these things and say, well, gee, is Ken Myers some left-wing guy? Well, I don't think I am. But the Alliance for Childhood, for instance, their two reports, a lot of wonderful wisdom about practical, practically challenging some of the claims of the roles of technology in education. And asking for a kind of realism to emerge. They talk about, for instance, the necessity of recognizing the pace that at which kids actually develop well. One of the first observations they give in that report, Tectonic, is slow down. Honor the developmental needs of children. They talk about how the relationships with the real world should come first rather than relationships with the virtual world. They say choice implies limits and the option to say no. So, again, whereas our technologies imply an ideal of limitlessness, we are actually created to live within limits, not only moral limits, but within the physical limits of our embodiment. So anyway, while again, politically and theologically, I wouldn't agree with some of these points in their studies, nonetheless, there's some wonderful questions that they raise. Michael Bujeha, I think is how he pronounced his name, a book that I've only recently discovered called Interpersonal Divide, The Search for Community in a Technological Age. I actually brought that with me because I'm still working through it. It's not particularly elegantly written, but he raises a lot of really helpful ideas. He's got a chapter in here called The Blurring of Identity and Place. He talks about there's a section on the disembodied self and how, again, with information technologies, the reality of our embodied life becomes less and less significant. And there's actually a lot of really interesting research showing how young people who've grown up online increasingly desire to escape the body. There's a Gnostic kind of temptation. The idea of uploading their consciousness to a computer is utopia. and getting away from embodied life entirely. Bushehha has some does have some specific applications for teaching. The next book, Breaking Down the Digital Walls, Learning to Teach in a Postmodern World. Lowell Monk serves on the advisory board for the Alliance for Childhood that's mentioned at the top. This is co-written by them, and I think they each wrote alternate chapters. And Monk, I think, is the wiser of the two and has some wonderful insights about how technologies distort our ends. He talks about working... He ran a computer lab for a high school, regional high school network, I think in North Jersey, for a number of years. And he talks about how he had... He was running two computer labs simultaneously in two adjoining rooms. One of them was for the college prep kids, accelerated kids, who were doing an online multicultural, intercultural communication thing. They were talking to students in Eastern Europe and Asia, and they were online getting to know these other cultures. And next door was a English as a second language. You're seeing where this is going. English as a second language computer lab for immigrant kids from like 30 different countries. And he said the bell would ring and these kids would walk past each other and they just walk on their way and ignore. And he said, something's wrong here. We're spending thousands and thousands of dollars to help these kids in intercultural communication online when the people in the next room are from other cultures. But they don't talk to each other. And he said, the reason is, it's you lose control. You actually have to face, you know, when you're face-to-face with somebody from another culture, suddenly you're not in control the way you are online. But he said, that's what communication is. It means you're not in control. You're in this common space. And so there are a lot of wonderful insights in that book. Richard de Grandpre, I already mentioned. Thomas de Zengatita, his book Mediated, is one of the best books I've read on how media promote what we sometimes call a kind of postmodern point of view, a kind of view of the self as a kind of sovereign chooser, and a view that questions the existence of reality in some ways. And it's a very entertaining book. Also, it has a wonderful section on mean middle school girls. That's worth the price of the book. Where do they exist in the social pecking order, and what are they going to grow up to become? Hubert Dreyfus is a philosopher who works principally in phenomenological philosophy, and he's famous for a book he wrote 25 years ago on artificial intelligence called What Computers Can't Do, and then a sequel, What Computers Still Can't Do, in which he questions some of the assumptions about artificial intelligence and the nature of knowledge. And on the internet is a collection of several short essays that deal with very explicitly with some educational themes, particularly the question of distance learning and what happens when you take learning out of the classroom and out of that face-to-face encounter. If I can say at the risk of sounding slightly bawdy, The best comment I've heard about distance learning was from the cultural historian Jackson Lears, who said, distance learning is to learning as phone sex is to sex. And I'll just let you work through that. Todd Gitlin's Media Unlimited, I already referred to. Richard Louv's Last Child in the Woods, Saving Our Children from Nature Deficit Disorder. That has a wonderful account about a kid like 10 years old who said he preferred being indoors to outdoors because he knew where all the outlets were. And again, I am a big believer in the fact that our engagement with creation is so much tied with our engagement with God and with our neighbors, that our engagement with creation is absolutely necessary. And it's a great shame that the pantheists started talking about nature before Christians did. Marshall McLuhan's Understanding Media, it's kind of a seminal work. Joshua Meyerowitz's No Sense of Place, The Impact of Electronic Media on Social Behavior, is a very helpful introduction to the whole idea of media ecology and how it shapes both our lives and our expectations. Christine Rosen, who I just mentioned, the new article on multitasking, she has done a whole series brilliant series on the technologies of everyday life and how they affect our expectations. I mentioned two in here, particularly virtual friendship and the new narcissism, where she talks about MySpace and Facebook and how it changes the very idea of friendship and the shape of relationships that young people have. She's done a wonderful thing on online dating. She has one on kitchen technologies. Are we worthy of our kitchens? I think she... But she's done one on plastic surgery. She's very perceptive. She's a Christian. She studied with Leon Cass for a number of years. And I'm looking forward to a book from her. She's actually written a book on another subject, but I'm looking forward to a book on this. Lee Siegel, a recent book called Against the Machine, in which he talks particularly about the world of blogging and how it disorders our understanding of how it's a new kind of journalism that has a lot of liabilities tied with it. Richard Schickel, I know, the LA Times movie critic, has referred to the blogosphere as a world of hairy-chested populism, in which, you know, kind of the loudest voice really wins. And Siegel raises, again, some very helpful questions. Then finally, Steve Talbot. You can read his first book online, The Future Does Not Compute, Transcending the Machines in Our Midst. He raises a lot of questions about technology. It is online at his website, netfuture.org. He also has a newsletter that he sends out fairly frequently with short essays on technology and culture. And then finally, his most recent book, Devices of the Soul, which I mentioned also, that does have specific essays on educational use of technology in education. We are out of time. Thank you so much. And I'll be around, so if there are questions.